Who's going to ask? You can ask? Okay. Bangladeshi style? Oh, you got some coaching. South Indian style?
Brahma cho lokadhipati sahampati katanjali anadhibharam ayachata santitho satta parajakho jatika Dese tu dhammang onukampimang pajang.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputtassa buddhang dhammang sangham namasami. I didn't realize that there's been quite a tragedy in the area. Ajahn, you might not know, Friday night, a tornado struck the Ottawa area. 100,000 people were without electricity. Some are still. It struck at two places. In Dunrobin, 600 people lost their homes. In 90 seconds, their houses turned into a pile of matchsticks. In Arlington Woods, Nepean, same scenario. People are devastated. Many people are offering their time and energy to help them. Could we offer our chanting and metta to all those people in town during our puja tonight? So we can think of them. Didn't even know what's going on. That's what you said when I came in. You said there's a tornado or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dunrobin, that's where...
Close to our families.
Yeah? Oh. Dunrobin's where the Thai temple is, too. It's uncertain. Okay, so I guess we can call this the fruit salad retreat. We have a video of all of us absorbing into our fruit salad. You don't want to make like Buddhism where you're, you know, eating becomes like a chore. You have to control. I think you want to make the whole practice actually interesting and fun. Fun, I don't know. Maybe that's too strong. But I was just thinking how I've always enjoyed training. Like as a young guy, I rode for University of Toronto, and I'd enjoyed basketball, and I enjoy learning how to use crafts. So there's something in me that likes the repetition of training. And you really need that if you're going to learn how to meditate. It's just because it's not going to come, you know, 5 minutes every half year. Sorry. And I just think as I'm meditating this afternoon, what is it that I like about the training? Well, I like the challenge because the mind's a really hard space to train, isn't it? If I'm just trying to control it all the time, then it just becomes onerous work. And certainly I did that for a while, and I was quite driven. But I had a community of men who were quite diligent, and it was a lot of wisdom around. So they guided me to a more skillful way of practice and training. So one of the things that I found, and I forgot to mention this earlier, was the lying posture. You know, I've talked a lot about that now, how to meditate when you're in the lying posture, lying down rather than lying breaking the precepts. So just to repeat, I've said this quite a few times. Say my 71-year-old body has, you know, it can stay up for a while. But if I want to meditate for 2 or 3 hours, which I like to do, then I found the lying postures is so supreme. Very, very good. So how do you do that? Well, most people fall asleep. Right? So it seems to be, you know, there's some challenge to kind of get it rolling. So like last night, I realized I was a bit too frisky with the Dhamma talk. It was Raji's Puer Tea. I had 2 glasses of Puer Tea, and Puer Tea gives you a nice buzz. But 2 cups, and, you know, 6 o'clock, not a good idea. So went back to my room, and teaching itself is a bit of a buzz, right? It gets you going. So there was not going to be much sleep. And so, like before I learned how to meditate on my back, then it would just be kind of, then I'd do probably a lot of walking meditation to while the night away. But now I find that you ever try to rub your eyes with your glasses on? It doesn't work. But now I can... I figured out how to do it. So what I do is I assume a lying position, a Sarvasana, and I put my hands on my thighs, and I get quite comfortable. I don't use like a hard floor. I'm just on the bed. I get my neck well supported. So I'm very comfortable. So I could, in theory, fall asleep, which would be all right. But the posture I use on the back isn't the one that I'm used to falling asleep. I usually fall asleep on my side. So that in itself is helpful. So I set out the posture, and I make the intention that this is meditation now. This isn't just an attempt to annihilate the mind in a different posture. So it is like the intention is there. This is meditation. And it is a formal posture, just like sitting cross-legged or doing walking is a form of posture. And all that, you know, because I've been trained that way, there are like formal postures for meditation, and there's daily mindfulness that puts in my mind quite a strong intention, what I'm doing. So it's not just, that kind of thing. It has this formality to it. And then I kind of try to get into a whole body awareness, as I talked about before, like when I said feel your mouth, feel your hands and all that, and then get a sense of whole body awareness. And then I do that. This is in awareness. So I really try to establish this kind of spacious awareness with the body as object. Not like super focused. And then I make a determination. Well, then I just readjust my posture maybe once, make it 10% more comfortable. And then I make a determination not to move. And that's very important. I just determine you're not going to move. Not in any kind of cruel, willful way, but just no, don't move. So that creates a strong intention. So you have these different intentions operating to remind me why I'm there. So then the first instance of movement, of the desire to move, and that comes very quick. You know, discomfort, you know, might arise within a minute. It's strange. And it's just the nature of the body. But it's obviously not hurtful. You know, there's nothing really painful. And then I don't move. And I just use that very desire to move, to look at the restlessness of the mind that creates. And I'm just with that. And then each iteration of that desire to move, which happens more when you drink coffee and tea, it's pretty serious. You kind of want to bounce around, actually. Just keep noticing that, because there's a lot of energy in the system. And then I try to use that energy. Well, normally I don't use coffee like that, but so then it's actually quite, once you get used to it, it's a beautiful posture because it's comfortable. You know, so you're actually, if you can get that one, it's quite of an attractive thing to do. Well, I think I'll lay down. You know, it's really nice, let's lay down. But now then it becomes a meditation. And if you kind of, so what if I talk to monks, they say, I just fall asleep. Well, I say, well, then you need to sleep, but do it when you wake up. You know, so have a good long rest. And then when you wake up, 4 a.m, whatever, go to the loo, brush your teeth, come back and lay down again. And just use, you know, now you've had enough sleep. So rather than do it when you're tired, so that's what I think you have to do if you're going to experiment. You have to do it when you have a lot of energy. And then explore what is it about that posture that you get, it's hard to stay present. So what happens, of course, is that the discomfort that comes is a signal quite often, I guess. I don't know, I don't have a set theory, but it seems that my body wants to roll over on the side to fall asleep. So I'm preventing it from doing that by just noticing the desire to move. And actually, I can sometimes, I'll be lying there for a long time, I'll say, no, yeah, I think it's time to go to sleep, whereas I'm not really that tired. And then I'll roll over on my side, because that's what the body likes to do, and eventually fall asleep. But I kind of keep meditating there too. Anyway, it's a great posture if you're my age, right? And knees don't work that well and so on. It's a good one to explore. And then if you like to do long sessions of meditation, it becomes quite useful that way. And then if you alternate sitting, walking, and lying down, three postures, then if you're into retreats, it can be really very, very fruitful. So give that a go. It's worth a try. But the joke in the monastery is we'll call it yoga nidra. Right? So obviously sometimes I just go for a snooze and I just go, I'm off to do some yoga nidra now. Oh yeah, there's the old guy. He's off again. But I've just this afternoon after the afternoon sit, just went up and did 2 hours of anapanasati. And the body felt great, whereas I couldn't, because my knees were having problems. So it was really having problems doing long, long periods of meditation in a formal posture. I could do walking, but even then my knees get swollen. So it's been really a boon to kind of reinvigorating those long periods of practice. And if you're into this, to training for such long periods, then it's obviously profitable. So do give it a go. And if you fall asleep, well, that's probably what you had to do. But if you wake up at 3 a.m, maybe consider, rather than just tossing and turning, maybe there's a profitable bit to insomnia. And then, if you get into that insomnia mindset, then you read all the literature that if you don't get 8 hours of sleep, you're going to get Alzheimer's tomorrow, and oh God, this goes on and on. But maybe not. Maybe you can rest in full wakefulness. And I think you can. I think you can rest in full wakefulness. So then if you do, you get up, up in the middle of the night, see if you can use that time as a meditative thing. Because tossing and turning really creates a lot of negative mindsets, doesn't it? I can't fall asleep. Your mind gets quite negative and grumpy. So, and I'm told elderly people have difficulty falling asleep, right? Something like that. So maybe there's a profit to being old, doing some more meditation. I wanted to tell a story just to make things light. So then I read this, but I'll tell the story anyway. Stories are good, Ken. Too much dharma and you get another piece of dharma. I don't think I can take it today. We just acquired some new land at the monastery. You might have heard we had 60 acres of land. And before I left for Thailand in December, this piece of land had come up for sale next to our property. And I'd often walked on it. It's a hunter's land. And I thought, wow, we can't afford this. We're trying to build a meditation hall. We need to save our bucks for that. So I went to Thailand and I talked to Ajanyana Dhammo, who is the abbot of the monastery where Ajahn Sumedho lives. And then I was walking in the forest behind Ajanyana Dhammo's monastery it's near another monastery, where there's a very famous teacher called Ajahn Gunha. And Ajahn Gunha is a nephew of Lompo Cha, and he's very, very famous. And he's a great philanthropist. He's sponsoring the patron of a 15-story hospital in Korat, which is a huge undertaking. And this forest in Kauai Park is also a sanctuary. It's a World Heritage Site. It's a beautiful forest. And his monastery backs onto it, and Ajanyana's. It's about a 45-minute walk between the two. And so Ajahn Gunha also does a lot of conservation work, and he's been instrumental in increasing the population of wild bison. This is a magnificent, they call them griting in Thailand, magnificent, like 10-foot tall beasts. They're just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And they live in the park, and there's elephants in the park, but what they tend to do is they come down and eat the sugar cane, and then the villagers shoot them and do things like that. So he's created, it's a very hilly place, the park, and he's taken out a lot of weeds that were covering hillsides and regrassed it with fodder that the griting like, and he's increased the population. He's doubled it now. So he's done a lot of work. And but he's also rather eccentric, monk, in that he's lived a very ascetic life, and he was one of the most ascetic monks that we know. But his mind was always very, very silent, very, very silent. So he would go like Tudong, walking about with maybe 100 monks. And they would just walk through the countryside, and then they'd set up places to stay, and then he would just stay up all night talking to the lay people. He's a very, very powerful mind. And now he's got a huge monastery, and how many people can stay there? How many? 2,000. So 2,000 people can, that's room and board. It's a bit bigger than Tisarana. So you're going to get the scale. In a sense, I saw Itza there in December. So that's just to set the stage. But when he receives people, he's in a large room in the open air, and he sits on a higher seat, and he's quite a big fella, a venerable monk. and he's very, very compassionate. He's always talking about metta and that. And next to him, there's a large bowl of sweets. I won't do it. and you watch his hands, there's a lot of energy. You know, and so he'd be talking and then throw the sweets at everyone, which is very curious. And then people grab the sweets. And I was almost tempted to do it. Oh, that's fun. And, or sometimes, people will bring these little juice boxes, so I have juice boxes, and then he'll just chuck these. Everyone's catching them. So then when I come, guess what? I have to chuck the candies and juice boxes too. But it, you know, it's there's something kind of really, I don't know, childlike and innocent about it all. It's strange. But once you get into it, you see he's a very, very loving man, and he's got this thing about feeding everyone. Just wants to feed people. Okay, so you need that to set the stage. So I sometimes walk to his monastery to pay respects to him, and this time I had walked halfway, and I was with a Thai monk, and then I'd gone into the forest. And in the forest, there are many trails, and they're four-wheel drive navigable trails. And as we were walking along, there was a white SUV, and we walked past it, and just past it, there was a monk clearing some brush with a layman, and he pointed back and said, Ajahn Gunha was in the SUV. And he knows me quite well, and because I was at Wat Bapong when he was there in the early days. And so I walked back, and the driver was on the other side, so some window came down, and guess what? He gave me a chocolate bar. What else did he do? So, great. Cute. And so we walked on, and the Thai monk is very fluent in English, so Ajahn Gunha isn't fluent in English. And we sat down, had some water, eating our chocolate, and then here comes the SUV. SUV stops in front of us, window rolls down, guess what? Another chocolate bar. Thank you very much. So I just stayed there and ate two chocolate bars, and drank the water, and then we got up and we started to walk, and now the SUV's coming back, all right? And he pulls over, and I kind of think, well, he just wants us to get by. So I start to walk by. He puts the window down, and now he invites us into the back of the car. So the monk and the layman are somewhere else, and he said, would you like to go see the Grating? I said, oh, fabulous, yeah, this will be fun, the buffalo. So I sit in the back of the car, and almost immediately he asks me, are you trying to get some new land? And I said, whoa. And I look at the Thai monk, and he looks at me. Now, how did he know that? Anyway, I went for it. So I explained to him and told him, and then we drove, and then he asked me another question, and how much is it, and then we talked about something else, and then he kept going back to this, and how big is it, and what does it cost, and I said what the asking price was, and then we finally got to a large reservoir, and there was a fence that went up right up a hill, and a gate, and he had the key to the gate. So, and this is a World Heritage Site. And he's got the key to the gate. It's great. So it's obviously his playground. So they open the gate, and we drive through. They lock the gate, and we go up a hill, get to the top, and there's this most beautiful Grating. Just this beautiful animal. It's almost like it's waiting for him. Just looking at us. And then he turns around, and we go down and get another, and there were 30 of them on a hillside. And it was just so beautiful. And you felt, these are his pets, or these are his friends, or however you want to say it. And he's obviously just cared for them, so. And he created reservoirs and food and so on. So we get down and come outside the fence again, and there's a dam near the reservoir, and he stops the car, and there's lay people there saying hello, and he rolls down his window and gives them chocolate bars. What else would he do? It was a very magical kind of situation. and then he keeps asking me about this land, and finally says, yeah, I'd like to support that. I said, really? And I look at the time, like, yeah, he said, really? Okay, great. And so then it's getting dusk, we're approaching the monastery, and as we get near the monastery, there's a dog. Car stops, dog wags its tail. You know where this is going. And he comes over to Ajahn Gunha's side, Ajahn Ganhal rolls down the window and gives him some dog food. It's beautiful. Oh, he had food for everyone. Very beautiful. So then he locked me off at the monastery, and then I went to pay my respects before leaving Thailand. I said, can I just check on that? Did you really say that you are willing to support this? He says, yeah, go for it. So then I got back, and then I told the committee and persuaded them that, you know, this was a good idea because we didn't have the money for it. And then we started to negotiate, and one more time, I wrote back to him, is this still on? And he says, yeah, go for it. So we went for it, signed the contract, and we closed the deal mid-June. And he sent his people, it's not his money, it's his people, eventually they raised the funds and sent the money. So we have 60 acres of land. And you know, what a feeling, right? That it comes that kind of magical way. And some of the property actually has a toe onto Pike Lake. And of course, as soon as people found out we're on Pike Lake, they donated a canoe and a kayak. That's how it works. So we have a flotilla now. Kind of just magical story. Good story? Yeah. So maybe I could have a go at some questions, yeah? I thought just to change the pace a bit. Anything else you might say about perceptions would be very helpful. I go around in circles trying to figure out if my perceptions of myself are true or not, but now it occurs to me that it's irrelevant. What they are first and foremost is unreliable, uncertain. Is that what you mean when you say make the Dhamma your own? Yeah, you could say that, yeah. So what you're doing in again, Buddhism has two kind of avenues of approach in its teaching. One is the social, and one is the, as you might call, flow of consciousness. So in the social, that's where morality comes in, generosity, social responsibility, social justice, ecology, and making sure that your alms bowl is clean. So it's the real things of how we live our lives. And then that's where we use the sense of me. I am a person living in the world with responsibilities and a passport and so on and so forth. And that's valid. And then the other is to have a kind of second level of consciousness functioning all the time, witnessing the flow of consciousness. And here, what we try to see is body is body. And so when I say to you whole body awareness, you know, what you're doing is you're witnessing body as a vibratory, elemental temperature experience, rather than body as concept or perception. Body as body. And then feeling, the feeling of attraction or repulsion as an object in awareness, as a part of flow of consciousness. So, and that's a given part of being human, that not only are we sense beings, that sensitivity also implies push and pull. If I feel pain, my consciousness knows there's a kind of resistance because it's painful. And if I taste something pleasurable, there's attraction. So there's a attraction and pushing and pulling, I call it. I kind of look at it like the kind of magnetism, you know, polarity, negative, positive. And that's a given, right? Otherwise, you couldn't really be, in a sense, body. You couldn't function. That's a given. And then the whole thing also that we have perceptions, mind. So not only do I see that as light, but I know it's a light bulb, and I know there's a switch for the light bulb, and I know what light bulb does, and I know what light does. So I have a whole set of perceptions, which makes me able to negotiate the world and understand the world and be in the world. And then we have all the complicated constructs of consciousness and thought patterns, and then we have all the emotions, which have both feeling components and mental components. And so we live in, and that's the way we talk about stream of consciousness now. You can experience life as a social being where you have responsibilities, and then you can also witness to the flow of consciousness. And that's when we talk about anatta or not self, that's what we're trying to do. We're not making an absolute about it, but you can witness to the nature of personality as something which is an object. So you can witness a grumpy personality in consciousness and an expired personality, right? It's interesting, isn't it? I find that fascinating. I can witness being, you know, bloody-minded, or I can witness being kind. Both of those are possibilities that can come up. So there you see that personality is not really who you are, and yet personality is personal. Because the personality characteristics that I experience are different than yours. So there is individuality in stream of consciousness, but you can't really say that you are, like, am I essentially bloody-minded or kind? Both exist. So in that stream of consciousness, what you want to be able to just see, oh, body is body, perception is perception, conception is conception, thought is thought, and just see it as flow, arising, ceasing, rising, ceasing, rising, ceasing. And the difficult bit is, of course, the attachment to craving, the resistance, the wanting, the not wanting, and then what gets embedded in that are habits of aversion or fear or worry or anxiety or resentment and so on and so forth. So in this question, but it now occurs to me that this is irrelevant. What they really first and foremost are unreliable, uncertain, and they're just perceptions. Now, once you can get to that, you know, and let's say I've just suffered from years of inner persecution. you know the feeling? Years of inner judgment. You know, you're bad, bad monk or bad, guilty, and you've just suffered that. And then one day you just see, you know, you're meditating and just see that perception arise. You're hopeless. And that's an object. And then it ceases. So then you don't even have to argue its veracity. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to everyone. It's just something that arose and ceased. And then you begin to see Dharma. Yeah, this is Dharma. If your boss says to you, you're hopeless, and you're not, you know, programming correct code, and it's costing the company millions, well, you better listen to that. It's the perception will much help you keep your job, right? But what we're doing now is kind of... Now, some people might think this is very narcissistic. You're kind of always thinking about yourself, but you're not. You're just more aware of how the mind works. And from that understanding, you're just more and more skillful in not believing that the endless rubbish which perceptions can create. It is, isn't it? I mean, the kind of lies that I believed in. Ajahn Sumedho says he just doesn't believe his mind anymore. He believes silence. You know, silence for him, he's a very silent man now. Silence is for him where the good answers come. So percept the kind of, and this is this, like, I go round and round in circles trying to figure out if my perception of myself are true or not. And none of them are true. None of them are false. They just, you know, they just are, because there is real no essential personality. Yeah? And this is really weird. But once you get to that, once you trust silence, and you have a good moral basis for living your life, and you have friends, and you have pursuits, and you feed the chickadees, and you do things, and you go canoeing and all of that, then where your decisions often come from are very good places, from silence, from compassion, rather than from some kind of abstract personality. So if you can see that, you know, perception is perception, that's a huge step in understanding Dharma. the Dharma perception as a kind of very important. Yeah? And that was that. What's this one? Oh, that was the disaster. He spoke last night about using perceptions. It's uncertain to help bring us back to the awakened mind. This is very helpful. Can you speak more about the different qualities of attention in awareness? Well, quality of attention. Awareness I don't see as a quality. Attending to something, I might attend to it from an intention. So I might say, ooh, I really like his recorder. I want his recorder. Which might then impel me to go looking on Amazon to try to buy it. So now I'm looking at something with a sense of wanting. So the intention is driven by, well, first of all, I'm attracted to it. You know, maybe I like gadgets. I really don't, by the way. Don't buy me one, please. Please. This is what happens. I get 10 of these. Honest. But so what happens is with contact as condition, there's visual image, and for some reason, my makeup, it's pleasant. Right? And because it's pleasant, I want to maintain the pleasant, so what to do? Buy one. But I don't have any money, so I give up and I go home. I'm saved the trouble. Someone else has money, they go, oh, yeah, I'd like one of those. And then the mind, I'm aware, I'm attending to that with desire because it's pleasant, but I might not be aware of that. I might not be aware of it. Huh? And I might think this is, my true edification and happiness depends on me getting that. That's the rational mind. It does that. And maybe I need two. So if I'm not aware of that, then I'm just a victim. I'm just a victim to everything that's pleasant. And culture's very good at. I'm just reading Harari's book, the third one, the 21 Questions for the 21st Century. And he puts it so well. He says, you know, we're so conditioned, like the Coca-Cola ads for decades now have been portraying very athletic people drinking Coca-Cola. They don't use diabetic people who are overweight and are dying, which is the truth, right? Which is the truth of Coca-Cola. It's a very graphically put how it works. Or I could attend to that in a different way. I think, where do you get that crappy thing anyway? What kind of taste have you got, Nisanka, anyway? You know, you thought you were a high-tech engineer. So I could be, mocking my good friend Nisanka because of his poor taste in recording equipment. And I might think that's the truth if I was really, arrogant and conceited. I mean, these are... These are exaggerations, but so what is important about attention is the intention behind it. Why am I paying attention to that? Why is the quality? What is the quality of my attention? Now, it might not seem like a big deal around that, but it is a big deal when you're watching the breath, right? Because if I'm observing the breath with the desire to be peaceful, and I'm not attending to that, And then my mind keeps bringing up thoughts. I could get very impatient and then try very hard, but I wouldn't see that actually I'm suffering from desire and aversion. And I just, give it up. So intention then around those things is much more subtle or more difficult. I have a memory of maybe something awful that happened to me last week, and that memory manifests in consciousness, and I think I'm aware of it, but actually I'm not aware of it. I'm just trying to get rid of it. So I watch my breath in order to try to get rid of the memory. It doesn't work. So then you can see how intention affects attention, and the awareness of that is very primary to the results I'm going to get from that. So that's why I'm try to bring people back to this sense of desirelessness, non-becoming, awake, non-aversion. So if you get there, then you can make choices which are really skillful. But if you don't get there, so how do I get there with a bad memory? Or then take it even more to more difficulty. How does someone get there with who's had child abuse? And this does not work then. You know, this kind of practice doesn't, then you need people need professional help. It doesn't work, it's just too subtle. Then you need like really skillful therapy and guidance and you know, all kinds of good ways that our culture has. So this is for those who have little dust in their eyes. Someone who's been really battered by life in some way, war, whatever, they need a lot of help, special help. And I certainly, like if someone in the monastery has like deep problems like that, then we seek out therapists. Because I don't know what to do. No idea. And I know that just watch it, be aware. That doesn't really work. Huh? So there are limits to this. And in general, that in the sense that there is awareness and then there's the quality of attention. That's very important. So the more I can, again, just to hope I'm not repeating this too much, but the more I can do that kind of attention without any desire in it, and get that skill around this very unchallenging kind of place. And the mind's always challenging, but in a place where you're safe, let's say you're safe, and I really understand how to do that, then I have more chance of applying that to the more difficult material of the mind. And then if I do that, then I say, oh, I just have to be patient with this one. It'll change. And I can, you know, I can taste the grapefruit or whatever. It'll change. It's uncertain. And then it ceases. And that's quite a skill, isn't it? Quite a skill to be able to do that. All right. Now I'll leave that for your reflection tonight.
Andamayang dhammakatha sadhukarang dadamase sadhu 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 anumodami.
We're getting there. Shall we chant for our brothers and sisters in the Ottawa area? Let's see what we can find.